Okay, good morning, everybody. I hope you're well. You know the saying in English that you feel like $1 million. Baruch Hashem, I feel like $3.8 million. As you know, Or Sameach had a big, a gigantic fundraiser, and Baruch Hashem, we were supposed to raise 3.5, and we raised 3.8. So I do feel like $3.8 million, and thank you for all of you that were mishtatef. I very much appreciate it. Today, I'm going to digress a little bit, although I almost digress every week, one way or the other, and that is because this week we have the fast of Asara B'Teves. I do want to talk about the fast of Asara B'Teves, but it will be obviously connected to the theme, the general themes of Mishlei overall. Someone showed me, I saw yesterday a schmooze from Victor Miller. Apparently they're putting out Chumash Shiorim every week. And this was a pretty tough schmooze, even for Rabbi Miller. Rabbi Miller, you know, kind of gives it to you. And Rav Miller said that the words that we read in yesterday's Parsha, when Yosef finally reveals himself to his brothers and says, Ani Yosef, Rav Miller says those are the scariest words in the whole Torah. They are scarier than the punishments. They are scarier than everything else in the Torah. Because Ani Yosef is the ripping away of all of the veils and all of the excuses and all of the rationalizations and all of the forgetting. As in the course of our lives, we unfortunately do many, many things that are not so good. And we sometimes hurt people. But we put it out of our minds, or we give ourselves excuses, or we give ourselves rationalizations. And the brothers did the same thing. The brothers had all sorts of rationalizations for what they did. The Sephorno, in fact, says that the brothers held that Yosef was a rodef. Yosef was endangering them because he was planning on making a rift between them and Yaakov, just as Yishmael was expelled from the heritage of Abraham, and Esav was expelled from the heritage of Yitzchak. The brothers thought that Yosef was trying to replicate that pattern. And that wouldn't have only affected them, that would have affected their eternity, that they would not be part of Am Yisrael. So they felt halachically they had the right to get Yosef out of the way. Initially kill him, and as a secondary plan, at least sell him into slavery, so he wouldn't be a factor. But then they see after so many years that this very Yosef that they despised, that they hated, that they thought was actually an evil person, was the one that Hashem had designated to take care of them, and the one that had risen to greatness, and the one that had shown everyone that a Jew remains faithful to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, whether he is at the bottom of being a slave in a prison, or whether he is the greatest leader, mainly in the world. So at that point, the brothers understood that all of their reasonings were just excuses, that all of their rationalizations were just cover-ups for the hatred that they felt. And Rav Miller points out, again, it's from a medrash, really, that this itself is the greatest mussar and the greatest tochacha. It's simply becoming aware of what it is we truly did and why we truly did it. And that itself is the greatest, greatest mussar, the mussar of self-awareness and truth. In fact, some have said that the very definition of Gehenim, what is the pain of Gehenim? The pain of Gehenim is Hashem allows us to feel the pain that we caused others without the excuses that we gave ourselves. And therefore, actually, Ephraim Voloshner says it, Gehenim is not a place you go to. Gehenim is something we create. Gehenim is simply experiencing the repercussions of our actions without the defense mechanisms that we commonly give ourselves. So, that's why Rav Miller concluded that Ani Yosef was the piercing of the veil the ripping away of the curtains, of the excuses, of the rationalizations. And indeed, Yosef makes the point, Ani Yosef, I am Yosef. Ha'od Avi Chai, is my father still alive? Now, obviously, that's not a question, because they were talking about Yaakov the whole time. This is a rhetorical question. Could it be that my father is still alive after all you put him through? I'm so amazed. I'm so surprised. So this is why the Medrash concludes on this whole statement, Ani Yosef, Oy lanu miyom hadin, Oy lanu miyom ha-teichecha. Oy, alas to us on the day of judgment. Alas to us on the day of rebuke, when Hashem will just reveal, really nothing more than just reveal, all of the things that we did that, you know, we're not so good, even though we give ourselves so many excuses all the time. So this is indeed something very, very frightening, but we know that Hashem is also a God of mercy and a God of love. And the very fact that he gives us a parsha like this is designed to give us the insight so that perhaps we don't have to live with that sense of delusion, and we can honestly confront what it is that we need to confront. I mean, that's a great, that itself is a great nechama. I mean, Meir Simcha writes in the Meshech Chochma that what a chesed it is that Hashem has given us the Torah. Because think about it, if Hashem didn't give us the Torah, we would literally have to invent the wheel. We would have to grope and look for ways to come close to him, and without any instruction, without any direction. He gave us the directions. So instead of looking at it like a burden, it's an amazing thing. It's like a roadmap. Hashem gave you a roadmap. Without a roadmap, how are you going to get to the destination? There may be individuals that could do that, but they would be very, very rare. That might be the Madrega of the Avos, who understood the Torah intuitively, meaning they somehow knew the map without being told it. But for most of us, that would have been literally impossible. So the Torah is not something that makes it hard. The Torah is something that actually makes life much more easy and much more pleasurable than it otherwise would be. So that's kind of a general perspective. As they say, Rabbi Miller went on again. I don't want to repeat the whole thing. This I think was unusually tough. He was going on and saying that everybody's sick, everybody's in a hospital, everybody needs to be in a hospital because of our midos, because of our environment. He said that at least he offers a walk-in clinic. He said, but even so, people really need even long-term hospitalization. And he described himself, he said on himself in his humility, he said that he himself is also sick, but Baruch Hashem, he spent his formative years with the greatest doctors of the soul in the world in Slobodka, he says, and they treated him extremely intensively. And as a result, he says, he feels he was at least a little bit of refuah, but still, there's a lot more work to go through. So, as Chazal say, Anan manana basrayu. What can we say after them? If this is what the great people said, even on themselves, then certainly we also have a lot of work to do. So one of the occasions in which are set aside really to give us the opportunity for cheshbon ha-nefesh are the fast days that we have throughout the year. And Baruch Hashem, Judaism is not filled with fast days. We don't have it. There's some tzaddikim who used to fast every Monday and Thursday. Every Monday and Thursday. Now that's kind of hard. But Baruch Hashem, for most of us, we are actually discouraged from fasting too much. But the fast that we're going to be observing is the fast of the 10th of Teves. But in the Shulchan Aruch, it is recorded that tzaddikim fast for 3 days in a row. They eat at night. They fast on the 8th of Teves, the 9th of Teves, and the 10th of Teves. And there's a particular reason for each of those days. The 10th of Teves, let's go backwards, is the only one that's an obligation, unless one is sick or the like. It's a lenient fast, so if one has any type of medical condition or discomfort, they should talk to a rav. I mean, it's relatively easy to have a dispensation among some chassidim. Women don't fast at all on the 10th of Teves. Again, I'm not giving a psak, but one should ask a shayla if there's any difficulty. But other than that, there is a chiyuv. And the 10th of Teves was the beginning of Nebuchadnezzar's siege against Yerushalayim for the Chorban Bayis Rishon, the first Beis HaMikdash, which culminated in breaking through the city 3 years later on the 9th of Tammuz, and then the temple being destroyed 3 weeks later on the 9th of Av. You'll notice in the first Beis HaMikdash, the 17th of Tammuz was not the relevant date. It was the 9th of Tammuz. So Asara B'Teves, beginning of the siege. 3 years later, the city was broken into. 3 weeks later, the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed. So as a result, Asara B'Teves is the first fast. It's the earliest fast. It's not the earliest in the year, because Som Gedalia is earlier, but in terms of the events, it is the earliest of the events connected with the Chorban Beis HaMikdash. Som Gedalia is actually the last one, because again, Asara B'Teves, beginning of a siege, 9th of Tammuz or 17th of Tammuz, we'll discuss that shortly, the city was breached, 9th of Av, the Mikdash was destroyed, and the Tishrei after that, after the Chorban Beis HaMikdash, Gedalia ben Achikam was murdered, who was the last Jewish governor of the remaining population in Eretz Yisrael. So, and according to most Shitas, Gedalia was actually killed on Rosh Hashanah, but since you don't fast on Yom Tov, so the fast was made in the 3rd of Tishrei, the first day after Rosh Hashanah. So Asara B'Teves is the earliest, chronologically, of the fast days that are connected with the Chorban Beis HaMikdash. I'll come back to that. I first want to talk briefly about the 8th and the 9th, and then we'll go back to the 10th. The 8th of Teves, totally different event, unrelated event, an event that happened during the second Beis HaMikdash. And that was, according to Chazal, this was the day that the Septuagint was completed. The Septuagint is called Targum HaShivim, and that is Talmai HaMelech, Talmai, who was a successor to Alexander. Remember, the whole Hanukkah story is the battleground between the Seleucid dynasty in Syria and the Ptolemaic dynasty in Egypt. Eretz Yisrael went back and forth like a football, etc. But one of the Ptolemies, that was like the dynastic name, decided to create the equivalent of a national library. In fact, it was one of the wonders of the world, in which every book, of course there weren't that many books in those days, but every book had to be translated and kept in his library. In Egypt, and he wanted a translation of the Torah, and he got 70 elders, and he put them in separate rooms, and they translated the Torah into Greek. We have their work, and this is called the Septuagint, which is the 70. In scholarly literature, it's LXX, which is just the Roman numeral for 70. And miraculously, they came up with the same translation, including deviations from the literal translation, in order to preserve shalom. So, for example, the very first three words of the Torah, Bereishis bara Elokim, in the beginning God created, well, you could translate it erroneously, the beginning created God, meaning God was created in the beginning. So they inverted the word order in Greek to make it clear that God created time, God created the beginning. Or another example, the Gemara says, in the list of non-kosher animals, there is listed the arnevet. The arnevet is a rabbit. The rabbit is tamei, not allowed to eat it, even though they're cute, but a rabbit is a treif animal. Apparently, Mrs. Tolmai's name was whatever the Greek name was for rabbits. So they didn't want to put her name, because that would have been a big insult that she's Tomei and Treif. So they changed it to some euphemism and the like. By the way, it's also interesting, we don't have time to get into the halachic detail, that the Septuagint also translated certain verses to communicate the idea that killing of a fetus, an abortion, is murder, which is not the halachic position, but the Septuagint translated the Torah as if it is. And I want to point out that although the Septuagint was done by Chachamim, was done by Jewish scholars, it had very little influence in Yahadus. It was not treated as a sacred book. And the Septuagint was enormously influential in the Christian world, because that is how many of the church fathers, although they knew Hebrew, but most of their knowledge of the Torah was through the Septuagint. And, again, I don't want to be marach in this, it could very well be that the position of the Catholic Church that abortion is tantamount to murder is actually through the Jewish influence of the Septuagint, although that is not the halacha. Abortion is forbidden, but abortion is actually not murder under halacha. But the Septuagint kind of entered the Christian church much more so than it entered the Jewish religion. So according to, by the way, someone asked Rav Huttner once, are we supposed to believe this miracle that people were in different rooms and they came up with the same text? That sounds too unbelievable. So Rav Huttner said, if they would have been in the same room and came up with the same text, that would even have been a greater miracle. So he says, the miracle isn't so great as you would assume. But okay, Rav Huttner was a man of enormous, besides being a gadol, enormous wits as well. But okay, now the question is though, it says that the day the Septuagint was completed was a day of darkness and tragedy in Am Yisrael. And it's not clear, the Chachamim don't really say what's so bad about it. This is a translation of the Torah into Greek. What is so bad? It made the Torah more available, more accessible, even to Jews, because Alexandria, during the Bayit Sheni, was a huge Jewish community, and many of them could not read Hebrew. Many of them learned the Torah only through the Septuagint. In fact, Philo of Alexandria, who is a great Jewish philosopher, people argue religious or not religious, Philo declares that in Alexandria, the 8th of Teves was a Yom Tov. They would celebrate the day the Septuagint was completed, and yet the Chachamim took the position that this was a tragedy. So there are different ways of understanding it. One way of understanding it is the Chachamim were very concerned about the distortions. The translation distorted some things, and it's never right to introduce any distortion in the Torah. Others say, by translating the Torah into Greek, you made it more accessible to the nations of the world, who could then distort and misinterpret. And a third interpretation is that the translation was actually a good thing, because it helped many Jews read the Torah. But it was sad and tragic that the Jews were so illiterate in Lashon HaKodesh that they needed the crutch. So this is an interesting phenomenon. On one hand, it was a very good thing, but it was very sad that such a thing became necessary. I remember when the Art Scroll translations came out, the first Art Scroll translation was Megillas Esther, back in the 1970s. It was amazing. Art Scroll, Rav Meir Zladowitz, Zichrono Livracha, was a graphic artist. And Art Scroll did kesubos, that's what they did, and invitations. But he had a close friend who died, and he decided, L'zecher Nishmaso, to do a quick Megillas Esther in English with Meforshim, with the intention this would be a one-shot deal, and then he would go back to kesubos and invitations. I'm not even sure if there's still a Ksuver invitation division in Art Scroll, but whatever. But you can see how Hashem can, you know, gives a person a destiny that he never thought he would have, that Art Scroll then turned into everything that it turned into. And everyone likes to criticize Art Scroll, and you know, there are different criticisms, but you know, the point is that all of us who criticize Art Scroll, we have not put out the works that Art Scroll has put out. You know, when you translate a whole Gemara, then you can start criticizing how someone else did the job. You know, but until you do the job, you know, it's not really worthwhile and productive to be so critical. So I remember when Art Scroll came out, there was an article in the Jewish Observer. People were saying how great it was. Finally, rabbinic interpretations are available in English. So someone said, remember the 8th of Teves. That was considered to be a sad and tragic day. Yes, Baruch Hashem, everything is in English. But what a chaval it is that many of us are so unable to go back to the Makoros, and by definition, there's so much we're going to be missing. So that was the 8th of Teves. We now come to the 9th of Teves. And here the Shulchan Aruch says a very bizarre rule or statement. Shulchan Aruch says, some tzaddikim fast on the 9th of Teves, but the Chachamim didn't want to give the reason for it. In other words, yeah, some people fast, but we're not telling you the reason. Well, obviously, you can understand that if somebody tells you, I'm not telling you the reason, you really want to find out the reason. So the Mefarshim dig around, what could the reason possibly be? And if there is a reason, why wouldn't you want to tell us? Now, some say that on the 9th of Teves, Ezra was Nifter. Ezra was the great, great Navi and leader of the beginning of the Bayis Sheni. He was considered to be as great as Moshe Rabbeinu. If you look in the Slichos of Aser B'Teves, it mentions that the 9th of Teves is the yard site of Ezra HaSofer. But it's a little peculiar because we don't fast on Zion Adar, which is Moshe Rabbeinu's yard site. Why would we fast on the 9th of Teves? And moreover, if the 9th of Teves is simply the yard site of a great, great tzaddik, why would that be kept secret? Why would it say they didn't want to give the reason? There would be no reason to conceal that. We should know that we're fasting. L'zecher nishmas Ezra, who is shakol k'moshe Rabbeinu. So because of this, it is brought down in some makoros, a very, very mind-blowing idea, that the tzaddik whose yard site we are commemorating on the 9th of Teves is not Ezra, but it is the apostle Peter. Peter was one of Yashka's apostles, and Peter's original name was Shimon, Simon, and Peter Petra comes from rock, because Yashka called him my rock, and his Hebrew appellation is therefore Shimon Kippa. Kippa in Aramaic is rock. Chaf Yud Pei Aleph. Shimon Kippa is Simon Peter, and those who fast are fasting L'zecher nishmas Simon Peter. Why on earth would we fast L'zecher nishmas Simon Peter? So in the Machzor Vitri, the Machzor Vitri was a Perish on Tfilas produced by Rashi's Talmidim. It has many teachings of Rashi and many teachings of Rashi's Talmidim. It is brought down the following story, which may or may not be historically true, like nobody really knows, but this was a story that was preserved, and that is, the original Christians were, of course, Jews. Yashka himself was a Jew. And as Jews, they were praying in Jewish synagogues, they were etc. And the Chachamim saw this as a tremendous danger, that within Judaism, there would be segments of people who believed that Yashka was Mashiach, or Yashka was God, or that the commandments of the Torah were undermined. This was like a poison. This was like a cancer. And the Chachamim were debating, how do we get rid of this cancer? So Shimon Kippa was a member of the Sanhedrin, and he came up with the following idea. He says he knows he will be losing his connection to the Jewish people forever. But he said, he will make Christianity, so to speak, a separate religion and take it away from Judaism. He will separate the Christians from the Jews. And as a result, although Christianity will continue to be a negative and destructive force and even become much, much bigger and more powerful, at least it will be outside of Klal Yisrael. And will not be within Klaus. And as you know, Peter, of course, is the first bishop of Rome, which is the Pope. Peter is the essentially the founder of the organized church. And Peter said he will live the rest of his life. This is in Machzor Vitri. He will live the rest of his life as a goy, as a Jew who left Judaism and became Christian, in order that the Maminim of Yashka will no longer be part of the Jewish people. But he asked one thing. According to some traditions, he continued to keep mitzvos privately. Right, so the first pope was Jewish. There are legends about other popes as well. Canon Converso. And he also had one final request. This is all in Machzor Vitri. His final request is he wanted to be remembered by a prayer that he wrote, and he asked the Chachamim to please incorporate this prayer in the liturgy. And this is the prayer of Nishmas. The prayer of Nishmas that we recite every Shabbos and Leil HaSeder, according to Machzor Vitri, was authored by Shimon Kippa, by Simon Peter, the Apostle Peter, Yashka's closest confidant. He was a spy, so to speak, but he was his closest confidant. Therefore, the Chachamim, the Tzaddikim that were receptive of this tradition, they honored his memory by fasting on the day of his death, but they didn't want to reveal it because either the Jews wouldn't understand what it's about, and the non-Jews would also wouldn't, you know, they might hurt us, they might attack us because we're celebrating, and not celebrating, but we're kind of appropriating Peter for our own. That would be blasphemy from a Christian perspective. Yeah. Yeah, what do? Because you have a man who was willing to give up everything in order to protect Am Yisrael from negative influences. He basically said, I will leave Judaism, so I will take these renegade Jews with me, and they will not be a negative effect on Am Yisrael. My love and my care and my concern for the Jewish people is so great that I will sacrifice my own connection to Am Yisrael in order that other Jews will not be affected by these negative influences. Yeah. Yeah. That is true, of course. Yeah. Well, when I say we don't know, I mean we don't know this either. Meaning this is, I'm giving you a total story that is recorded, but there are people who doubt that story is true. Then we wouldn't know. In other words, it's either, I mean, we don't know. I mean, this story says it was Simon Peter. If you don't accept that story, then you don't know who the author of Nishmas is. Nishmas does not have a definitive author that we can point to. Now, you know, the prayer of Nishmas itself is an extremely powerful and beautiful prayer. Rebbetzin Kanievsky, Allah Shalom, used to tell people all the time, whenever there were tzoros, whenever there were things going on in their lives that were difficult, they should say Nishmas. So Nishmas is a very, very powerful tefillah, and just an amazing thing that there was a Masorah from the Beis Medrash of Rashi, from Rashi's Talmidim. Now, Rashi himself didn't say it, but Rashi's Talmidim, that Nishmas was authored by Shimon Kippa. They even find Ramazim in Gematrias. They find in various psukim an encoding of Shimon Kippa's name. So that is the unknown fast of the ninth of Teves that only the greatest tzaddikim, right? So the eighth of Teves was the conclusion of the Septuagint in the Bayis Sheni. The ninth of Teves, according to some, was the Yahrzeit of Shimon Kippa. The tenth of Teves is the earliest date of the three. That is when Nebuchadnezzar began the siege against Yerushalayim. I'm sorry, someone, yeah. No. I'm not sure why you're not following me. Yeah, let me repeat it, Bekitzer. Christians were Jews. They were functioning as Jews. When you have Christians in your minyan, when you have Christians at your Shabbos table, when you have Christians in your Gemara Shir, then they are going to missionize and proselytize and undermine. So Shimon Kippa's mission was to pull the Christian people, even if they were Jewish, pull them out of the Jewish community. so they would be clearly identified as outsiders and not insiders. And therefore, when a Jew hears some Christian attempting to proselytize, they will not look at it as a Jew speaking to them. They will look at it as an outside force. So his goal was to pull the poison out of the Jewish people, even if that meant he had to live with that poison himself. So chas v'shalom, it's not Judaism is a destructive force. Christianity within Judaism would be much more destructive than Christianity when it is outside of Judaism. Because when it is outside of Judaism, we know it's not Jewish. So yes, of course, Christianity oppressed us, killed us. Of course, it did enormous damage to us. But we always knew it was the outsider. It was not within Yiddishkeit. But until Shimon Kippa did this, people were confused. Just like today, you have Messianic Jews for Jesus. It's the same type of confusion. Well, in those days, all Christians were essentially Jews for Jesus. By the way, Derech Agav, you might have heard a very similar thing about Paul, meaning some actually say this was Paul's motivation, and that was a fairly popular theory in the 19th century. In a way, it almost makes more sense with Paul, because Paul, indeed, was the apostle to the Gentiles. Paul went out and brought all the goyim into Christianity. So there's kind of a bit of a mishmash, there's a bit of a confusion. Was it Paul that did this, l'shem shamayim? Was it Peter that did it? Did either of them act l'shem shamayim? Is the whole thing not a true story? Again, this is not a medrash, this is not chazal, so this is not something that we say for sure was true, but this was a tradition that some kehilos in Am Yisrael had that they preserved, but I cannot represent it as historical truth. Yeah. Yes. Right. The day of rest on Sunday. That's right. That's right. And then the question is, was Paul's motivation l'shem shamayim? Yeah, no, that's very true. I mean, again, if I had to make a choice, I actually would have said it would be Paul more than Shimon Kippa. But in the Machzor Vitri, Shimon Kippa is the one that is recorded. Yeah. That's correct. The confusion is coming back. Now, I will tell you that especially among people, I mean, obviously among people who have very little Jewish background, I can tell you that many immigrants from the former Soviet Union who strongly identified with being Jewish, they really, really, because they couldn't help it, actually. They were Jewish, and they knew they were Jewish, but they didn't know anything about mitzvos. So then they have some rabbi, in quotation mark, who wears tzitzis and gives kosher food and talks about Yeshua as the Redeemer. They fell for it. They fell for it. So among Russian immigrants, the Jews for Jesus, unfortunately, had a great, great deal of penetration. So you're correct. Some of the same problems that Shimon Kippa or Paul saw in the very beginning of Christianity has come back today. Yeah, yeah. Really, Rechavia, wow. What street? Ushishkin. Wow. Right near. I won't make a bad joke. It's right near my end up. Anyway, what do you do to something like that? You know, again, I'm not gonna advocate violence or anything like setting it on fire or whatever it is, because those things are tremendous chilul Hashem's. But the fact that in Yerushalayim Yir HaKodesh there would be mamish avodah zarah, and not just avodah zarah that goyim are doing, but avodah zarah that yidden are doing, is a real tragedy. It is a tragedy. And, you know, we hope that people will not be nichshol. Yeah. No. That's the point. He never believed. See, that's why we didn't want to publicize this, because if we were to publicize why we're fasting, we would be saying, Peter never believed your stuff anyway. So they would see that as an attack on Peter, right? That Peter's going to go to hell because he didn't believe in Yeshua. No, the assumption is Peter Vadai didn't believe, and he remained a Shomer Mitzvos privately, and he had to act like he repudiated Judaism as a way of creating leadership in the Christian world, creating the Catholic Church in Rome, right? The first bishop of Rome is Peter, indeed. Yeah. I don't think we have any makor even in something like Machzor Vitri, but there are later people that have maybe suggested that maybe the Machzor Vitri was mixing up Paul and Shimon Kippur, which is not so uncommon, meaning a lot of times in rabbinic literature, the apostles are all tzemished anyway. They use one name and they mean another name, etc. Whether you're allowed to do it? Well, you know, you have to understand that there are within halacha things called horas shah, which are emergency one-time things that are not necessarily general precedents. And we say, Eis lasos l'shem, when it's time to preserve Klal Yisrael, there are times that you can depart from the Torah. So this is kind of a horas shah. You can't automatically generalize. I did not see any particular discussion. It's such an unusual type of situation. But as they say, the Machzor Vitri apparently assumes it was permitted because it mentions that Shimon Kippur did not do it on his own. Shimon Kippur did it with the consent of the Sanhedrin. He would not have done it unless they agreed that this was the proper thing to do, if he was willing to make that sacrifice. So clearly there's a gushpanka, clearly there's a seal of approval on what he did. Yes. So this is the Machzor Vitri. Again, Machzor Vitri is treated as generally a very important source, mainly for halacha, not so much for history, but things that are recorded in Machzor Vitri, we do take seriously in that way. It's the Talmidim of Rashi. As I said, Vitri was just the city, and the Mechaber was Rav Simcha of Vitri, who was a Talmud of Rashi. Yeah.
This sounds like the story of the unseen, where the Maranos, the way they also, I don't know if they asked Rabbanim, but they, in order to preserve,
yes, but you see, it was very, very different. Again, we can't sit and judge on the Maranos because we don't know what we would do. But generally speaking, la halacha, if it's simply a question, convert to Christianity or I'll kill you, the halacha is you're supposed to give your life. So even though we can't blame the Maranos because who knows what we would have done, according to halacha, they should not have converted even externally. But this is very, very different. Peter was not converting or behaving as a Christian to save his life. His life was not in danger anyway. He was ensconced as a Jew. He was doing it to be matzil Klal Yisrael from what he regarded as a cancerous influence. That's a totally different cheshbon. This was a mesiras nefesh of his spiritual life. In fact, he even said, it's not clear that even if he's going to lose all of his olam haba, he will do this for Am Yisrael. Now, whether he lost it, didn't lose it, you know, we're not sure whether the zechus of Mesiras Nefesh would compensate for what he did. You know, we don't know. But this is a very different story. This was not becoming a Christian to save his life. His life was not in danger. This was becoming a Christian so that Klal Yisrael will not be adversely affected. That's a totally different type of story. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, no, you are correct. As soon as I said it, I realized I was not completely accurate. Most of us do not fast on Zion Adar. That, of course, is true. But, of course, most of us don't fast on the 9th of Tebes either. There are people who do fast on Zion Adar. It's a tainus of tzaddikim. And for among Chevrei Kadisha, it is very, very common. It's a very common minhag to fast on Zion Adar. Of course, the interesting question is, what does Zion Adar have to do with Chevrei Kadisha? I mean, Chevrei Kadisha are the people who bury the mason. Moshe Rabbeinu was the one mace who wasn't buried by a Chevrei Kadisha. He was buried by a Kadosh Baruch Hu. So, yeah. Yeah. Right, right. Very excellent. So that taka is one of the terut. Yeah, I'll repeat. That is one of the terutzim, that when Hashem buries someone, obviously Hashem is doing it for no ulterior benefit. In other words, there's no gain HaKadosh Baruch Hu gets. He has everything. So too, every Chevrei Kadisha is called Chesed Shel Emes. Chesed Shel Emes. Because they're doing Chesed to someone that's no longer around to pay them back. And therefore, what the Chevrei Kadisha is trying to give chizuk to their members is to say, we are emulating Hashem's midah of chesed shalemes, right? In fact, that's the Chevrei Kadisha. Chevrei Kadisha is called gemilus chasadim shalemes. You'll often see Chevrei Kadisha abbreviated ches kuf gimel shin ches aleph, meaning Chevrei Kadisha, the holy assembly of Gemilus Chasadim Shel Emes, of doing Chesed Be'emes. That's a very common Rashi Teva for that. Okay. All right. So now let's go to the 10th of Teves. Just say a little bit about the 10th of Teves. There is something, and this will tie into Mishlei. So even when we don't do a Pasuk, we always try to have a tie-in to Mishlei. And that is, what's interesting is, if you think about this, if you look at Shivas or Batamuz and Tisha B'Av, you see that they have a shaychus both to the first Beis HaMikdash and to the second Beis HaMikdash, at least in approximation. So Tisha B'Av, of course, was the day that both the first Mikdash and the second Mikdash were destroyed, 490 years apart, to the day mamash. Shivas or Batamuz, slightly different. It is the day that Yerushalayim was broken into, both by the Babylonians and by the Romans, but the difference is, in the first Mikdash, that day was the 9th of Tammuz. In the second Mikdash, it was the 17th of Tammuz. Chazal didn't want to make two fast days that are so close together, so they basically said, we'll pick the 17th, but when we fast on the 17th, we are thinking of the breaking down of the walls of Jerusalem, both in the Mikdash Rishon and the Mikdash Sheni. By contrast, the 10th of Teves commemorates a tragedy that is relevant only to the Mikdash Rishon. It is the beginning of Nebuchadnezzar's siege. In fact, we don't even have any record of when we have a record from Josephus, but we have no tainus for the day that the Romans began their siege against Jerusalem. So the question becomes this. So it turns out that, of course, Tzom Gedalia also is connected really to the Mikdash Rishon, but just focusing on Aseret B'Teves, it is a fast day where we primarily think about the first temple more than the second temple. Because nothing happened on the 10th of Teves that is relevant to the second temple. Now, why is that a problem? That's a problem for the following reason. All of us know the famous Gemara that the first Beis HaMikdash was destroyed because of the worst three sins, Avodah Zarah, Gilui Arayos, Shvichas Damim, idolatry, sexual immorality, and murder. The big three, the three sins that you have to die for before you violate. The second Beis HaMikdash, the Jews were largely keeping the commandments, and the destruction came because of sinas chinam, hatred, polarization, indifference, machlokas. In fact, Josephus describes scenes that there was such sinas chinam among the Jews vying for control of Yerushalayim that in the Beis HaMikdash itself, from one side of the Mikdash, Jews were shooting arrows at the other side, and Kohanim were ducking under the arrows to do karbanos. And he quotes Titus. Now again, anytime Josephus says anything, you have to take it with a great, great grain of salt, because Josephus was living under Roman protection. But Josephus writes that Titus told him, remember, Josephus actually spoke to Titus. Titus told him he doesn't think he has to destroy Jerusalem, because if he just waits long enough, the Jews will do it to themselves. And although, as I say, the fact that Josephus said something does not mean anything, but this fits what Chazal said about the degree of sinas chinam. Now, here is the problem I just want to raise, at least for a few moments. And that is, when we have a fast day that also commemorates the second Beis HaMikdash, like Tisha B'Av or the 17th of Tammuz, you can understand what your spiritual avodah is. We think about the reasons why the temple was destroyed. And in particular, we think about sinas chinam. And unfortunately, the sickness and the cancer of sinas chinam is very much with us. So I have something to latch on and something to think about and something to rectify. And that's how I mourn over the Beis HaMikdash, by resolving in my life to try to be misaken the averos that caused the Chorban. Okay? Am I guilty of sinas chinam? I surely am, on some level, one way or the other. So that's what I can work on. But, asara b'teves, since what we think about is not the second Mikdash, since what we think about is the first Mikdash, and the first Mikdash was not sinas chinam, it was avodah zara, gili araya shvichas damim, well, I'm not that bad. All right, sinas chinam, lashon hara, okay, I got what to work on. But avodah zara, gili arayos, shvichas damim, meaning, how do I relate, if asara b'teves is totally mechubar to the Mikdash Rishon, and the Mikdash Rishon is avodah zara, gili arayos, shvichas damim, I mean, am I supposed to assume that I'm guilty of those averos? Right, how do I understand it? So, here's a thought from Rav Tzadok that puts it in a very, very beautiful perspective. And he says, it may very well be true that most Jews, certainly most religious Jews, most, not all, even then, are Baruch Hashem not guilty of avodah zarah, gili arayos, shvichas damim. That may be true. But avodah zarah, gili arayos, shvichas damim are not just sins. They are symptoms of flaws in our character. And even if a person is asymptomatic, meaning he's not showing the extreme symptoms, but we still have to be misaken the flaws that in extremity give rise to those symptoms. What are the essential flaws? So this is a statement in Pirkei Avos. Pirkei Avos talks about the three factors that bring holiness into the world, and they are Torah, Avodah, Gemilas Chasadim, and that corresponds to Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. Avram is the pillar of Chesed, and Yitzchak is the pillar of divine service, and Yaakov is the pillar of Torah, right? And these are the three things. Al Shleisha Devarim Ha'olam Omeid. The world stands on these three pillars. But the same way that these are the three pillars that build the world, there are three forces that destroy the world and destroy us as individuals. And they are kina, taiva and kavod. Kina is jealousy, envy. Taiva is excessive lust for material pleasure. And kavod is looking for glory and ego gratification. And Rabbi Elazar says, Rabbi Elazar HaKapor says, Motzien Esa Adam Min Ha'olam. So here's what Rav Tzadok says. If you take kina to its extreme, jealousy, envy, I look at what you have and I want to take it away from you, then God forbid it could result in murder, taking a life. And indeed, if you look, most murders, putting aside terrorism and the like, which again, unfortunately, in Eretz Yisrael, we are more than used to. But if you simply look at the typical murder, let's say, in the United States, you will often find it was over jealousy, it was over rivalry, it was over, you have a jacket that I want, you have sneakers that I want. People just kill because they want something. The jealousy is overwhelming. So, jealousy is the shayrish of ritzicha. Taiva, lust, is of course, that's more logical, the shayrish of giloy arayos, where you cannot control your lust. And finally, now this is the most subtle, kavod, ego, and arrogance leads to avodah zarah. Because in the way we understand it is this, avodah zarah doesn't simply mean bowing down to a statue. Most of us do not bow down to statues. But avodah zarah is when anything in your life becomes the central principle other than serving Hashem. Could be your money, your possessions, your glory, your ego, your self-aggrandizement. You yourself become your God. And therefore, Rav Tzadok's point is, maybe I'm not guilty of the technical sin of avodah zarah, gilui arayos, shvichus damim. But the spiritual flaws that give rise to those sins, kina, taiva, kavod, if they are very much within our personalities, one way or the other, we need to uproot them, we need to look at them, we need to be honest, going back to Ani Yosef at the beginning of what I mentioned from Rav Miller. And therefore, Rav Tzadok argues, the cheshbon ha-nefesh that we go through is not only the cheshbon ha-nefesh of the second Beis HaMikdash, which is sinas chinam, but the cheshbon ha-nefesh of avodah zarah, gilui arayos, shvichus damim, which is the first Beis HaMikdash, because they represent kina, taiva, and kavod. And that very much, no matter how frum you are, no matter how religious you are, no matter how observant you are, these are poisons that can exist and do exist within our characters that we have to eradicate. Again, the connection to Mishlei is obvious, and the whole Sefer Mishlei is about focusing on those midos. But at the end of everything, let me point out that although I just said that Asara B'Tevis is only about the Chatoim of the Mikdash Rishon and not the Mikdash Sheni, we can turn around and connect it to the Mikdash Sheni as well. You know, if you look at the fasts of Shivas or Batamos and Tisha B'Av, you find that apart from their connection to the temple, they are rooted in an earlier Aveira. So Shivas or Batamos is the day that Moshe Rabbeinu came down from Har Sinai and saw the Egel and smashed the Luchais. So therefore, Shivas or Batamos, even disconnected from the temple, commemorates the tragedy of the Cheto Egel. Similarly, Tisha B'Av, the Meraglim came back from their 40-day journey on the 8th of Av, and they gave their negative reports. And that following night, the night of the ninth of Av, they all cried, not believing in Hashem. And Hashem said, you have made this night a night of crying for nothing. This night will become the night of true grieving. So, Shivas Arba Tamas is connected to Egel. Tisha B'Av is connected to Meraglim. What earlier sin is Asara B'Teves connected to? There's no clear mucker in Chazal. And I wish there would be a mucker in Chazal, because it's hard to imagine how a Sefer could just say this. But in later Svarim, it is recorded a tradition that Mechiras Yosef was on the 10th of Teves. And therefore, the same way the Chet HaEgel was the precursor for the fast of the 17th of Tammuz, and the Chet HaMeraglim was the precursor of the Chorban Beis HaMikdash, the Chet of Mechiras Yosef was the precursor of Asara B'Teves. Now that's so fascinating, because essentially this is combining First Temple and Second Temple, because the Chet of Mechiras Yosef is Vadai understood as an expression of Sinas Chinam and jealousy and animosity. So Memela, it seems to be reasonable, based on this assumption, that Sinas Chinam can still be something that one thinks about, even on Asara B'Teves, because it is connected to the tragedy of Mechiras Yosef. Now, the Chasam Sofer says one final thought. He says, it's brought down in some Sfarim that Asara B'Teves is so important that even if it would fall out on Shabbos, the Avudraham says, the Beis Yosef brings it, you would actually fast on Shabbos. Now, this is an unproven hypothetical, because based on the present Jewish calendar, Asara B'Teves can never be on Shabbos, but this is a hypothetical. Now the question is, why would Asara B'Teves be more chomer than Tisha B'Av? If Tisha B'Av falls out on Shabbos, we fast on Sunday, Saturday night and Sunday. That's the day of the Chorban itself. Why would Asara B'Teves, which was only the beginning of a siege, be halachically more chomer than Tisha B'Av itself? So here's what the Chasam Sofer says. We know if a person had a very bad dream, a dream about death or whatever it is, so some people fast for bad dreams, and the halacha is you fast even on Shabbos, because you're fasting not to mourn something in the past, you're fasting as a kapara that something bad shouldn't happen. The Chasam Sofer says, Asara B'Teves is the same thing. Every Asara B'Teves, Hashem determines whether the Beis HaMikdash will be rebuilt this year or not. Asara B'Teves is the Yom HaDin of Binyan Beis HaMikdash in the coming year. So we would fast on Asara B'Teves not simply to mourn what had happened. For that, you would never fast on Shabbos. Even Tisha B'Av, you don't fast on Shabbos. Yom Kippur is different. That's a Doraisa. But Asara B'Teves is like a Tainus Chalom. You're fasting as a prayer to Hashem that we should be Zoche to the Binyan Beis HaMikdash. So as a result, therefore, the day of Asara B'Teves is especially an important day to be Mispalo for the building of the Beis HaMikdash, because this is like the Yom Kippur and Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur of Binyan Beis HaMikdash. This is the day that Hashem decrees whether the Beis HaMikdash will be rebuilt this year. Now, it's true that every day we could bring the Mikdash, but again, just like Yom Kippur. On Yom Kippur, Hashem decides who will live and who will die. You can change it during the year, but it's much harder to change it once the decree is made. So we try to get our tefillos in before the decree is made. So B'ezras Hashem, may we be zocha to what the Navi Zechariah told us, that all of these fast days shall turn into days of sason and simcha, joyous rejoicing. May all of us be zocher to the Mashiach Tzidkenu and the Binyan Beis HaMikdash b'mehera v'yameinu.